Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. And tonight, we'll be continuing this deep exploration of the future of spiritual practice with a special encore presentation with researcher and visionary Jean Houston. Terry Patton is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series and online community, and our host tonight. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who coaches, challenges, supports, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you, Paul. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. Tonight, I have the delight and honor to be joined in conversation by Dr. Jean Houston, who is a truly remarkable human being, scholar, philosopher, researcher in advanced human capacities, one of the foremost visionary women of our time, a truly towering figure in the transformation of human culture for almost 50 years, and one of the principal founders of the human potential movement. She's a powerful and dynamic speaker, as many of you already know, and all of you will be discovering soon. She has worked intensively in over 40 cultures in 100 countries, helping diverse peoples enhance and deepen their own uniqueness while they become part of the global community. Since her childhood, she has connected or worked closely with some of the leading figures of our time, including Helen Keller, Teilhard de Chardin, Margaret Mead, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, and Bill, and especially Hillary Clinton. In 1965, along with her husband, Dr. Robert Masters, she founded the Foundation for Mind Research, and they co-authored the book Mind Games, which was celebrated by John Lennon's song by the same name. And she's worked extensively as an advisor to several UN agencies and is a past president of the Association for Humanistic Psychology. She's also the founder and the principal teacher since 1982 of the Mystery School, a school of human development dedicated to teaching history, philosophy, the new physics, psychology, anthropology, myth, and the many dimensions of human potential. She's also pioneered what she calls social artistry and conducts training in her school for social artistry as well. She's a prolific writer, the author of 26 books, including A Passion for the Possible Human, and Junk Time. It's a delight to welcome you, Jean, as my guest tonight.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's delightful to be with you.
Well, as you know, I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how our spirituality can play a key role in helping us rise to the challenges of a time of crisis and make this apocal evolutionary transition to a truly sustainable human presence on our planet. And we've had this whole series of adventuresome and probing and enlivening conversations, including a rich one with you on the mystical path. And in this moment, it seems like a time to push our chairs back and look at what is going on with this new emerging spirituality. How does that tie to this theme of our title, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, and in a sense, what's really going on here?
You know, Terry, it seems to me that we really are on the eve of a radically new order of spirituality. I mean, everything seems to point to it, from the hardening stances of fundamentalism to the great melange of world religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, coming together with shamanism, with yoga, with a new cosmology, with you name it. It's as if this ecology of spiritual and psychological and cultural disciplines is creating an entirely new mindset, and with it perhaps an entirely new mind. You mentioned that as a very young person, when I was 14, I met and used to talk on Tuesdays and Thursdays in Central Park with a man I called Mr. Teilhard, who turned out to be Teilhard de Chardin, and he kept telling me, oh, Jean, people in your time, we will enter the noosphere, the great sphere of mind. You know, the world mind would be taking a walk with itself, which is happening. So it what is happening is this new spirituality is not just about what's happening through instant communication and global socialization, because it would appear that a new nervous system is being woven in our time. I think very consonant with what Teilhard called the noosphere, and that we are present and participating in the creation of a global mind field. The planet is becoming self-conscious in all its parts through ourselves. And thus, I think that we are in the midst of the most colossal mystery play in history, as great as any drama of the soul that we read about in the world scriptures. I really believe that each one of us is on the stage of cosmic history and taking a role in this phenomenal play. And so this then greatly shifts what we have hitherto thought about as our destinies. I mean, before, our destiny was a given. Your name was Weaver. You lived on Weaver Lane. Your children were weavers. Your ancestors were weavers. And not too much more was going to happen. But now, given the extraordinary challenges, the extraordinary opportunities of our time, the emerging new spirituality and new ways of being, is that we enjoy a variety of destinies, a variety of purposes, from mediocre to magnificent. And of course, we also enjoy an enormous capacity to mess up completely by living a limited version of our destiny and of our purpose. And so I really believe that purpose in this most exciting and challenging of times is twofold. That yes, we have a local purpose, but we also have a global purpose. And taken together, they call us toward greater awareness and higher usefulness. And so I really believe that this art of purpose and destiny to be a new art form, in that it brings the genius, the passion, the vision of the artist to the work of co-creating and fulfilling your higher purpose, your higher destiny. Now, this also means that one has to create the internal practice, what you would call the integral practices, to be able to bring this purpose, this destiny into form, because otherwise you just go into radical regression and you really mess up. So that in this course, the 7-week course that I'm offering, I spend at least 4 or 5 sessions in which we really activate different capacities, sensory and physical capacities, so that you have much more capacity to become alerted to the higher purposes as they come your way. You are on a much more highly you have antenna on the possible that you didn't have before, because we literally help you reweave your nervous system and brain-mind system, as well as your physical capacities to engage the higher possibility. And then the whole psychological aspect of it, Terry. You know, we are not, as I always like to say, encapsulated bags of skin dragging around dreary little egos. We are organism environments. We are symbiotic with fields within fields and fields without our lives. We don't just dwell in the universe dwells in us. So how do you get beyond little local ego habituation, the barriers to new ways of being, but through, among other things, tapping into the fact that we have many, many different persona. We have a huge inner crew of the self, so that you can be you learn how to bring these other aspects of the crew, whether you call it the magician, the holy child, the painter, the artist, the scientist, the inventor, the rent collector, the technician, all these different people that we have. As for example, that one that I use, I happen to be a very, very good cook, but I hate to write. And so in order to do the writing that I am required to do, I literally bring up my cook, who has absolutely no problems and no phobias about anything at all. And so I literally cook up my ideas. I cook up my writings because I brought this other, cook persona forward. Then there's the whole fact that creativity is going on all the time beneath the surface crust of consciousness. And by altering attention on the spectrum of consciousness, one learns a way to access this enormous creativity. So we give a lot of training in that. We give training in the use of time differently. We give training in finding your higher story, your emergent myth, training in spiritual practices such as you so brilliantly teach in both your work and your books, and much, much more. But we find that by the end of that 7-week course, people have the wherewithal, the stamina, the passion for the possible, and the abilities to live out their purpose and their higher destiny, and to pick up on it as a continuous revelation.
That's beautiful, Jean. And in the arrival here, one of the things that I'm seeing is just like the first test pilots encountered as they were getting closer and closer to the sound barrier. There's a shaking that goes on as we begin closer to a new move. And there are an awful lot of folks who are feeling that tremendous, it's like we're coming up against a barrier that seems as though it's going to shake us apart. And people are coping with both these amazing, inspired intuitions of a new level of possibility and a tremendous amount of fear. And there's an inner tug of war between some different sub-personalities, which some of whom are feeling, I am striding forth into this new reality. This is my destiny. And others that are saying, oh my God, you fool. You are going so far out on the skinny branches, you are going to have your head cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And so often I hear people confessing this fundamental issue, and even as they reground themselves in their spiritual resources and their human resources, even as they try to apply discernment and balance, this theme resurges again and again. And I wonder if you have anything specific to say to that.
Well, I believe that this is the theme of the great heroic journeys, both hero and heroine. We feel the call. And then, of course, all the habituated forms and the fears that you rightly speak of rise to make us, and that's galloping entropy, you know, that cause us to try to stop the call and to go back to same old, and a life of serial monotony. And then we can't stand ourselves anymore. We just can't stand it. And so the hound of heaven going, rough, rah, 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 you know, at our feet, come on, stupid, get on with it. And so, you know, and so they go to your courses. They go to my courses. They enter now in this extraordinary new power of the internet and the virtual realities. What is happening is that it's as if opportunities are arising to meet the necessity of rising to these new challenges, and also to have a bonded community of people who will share in these integral practices so that you are not alone. And I think that part of it is the fact that we are being called to a greater story that is allowing our lives to be writ larger. And one of the things that you and I both do, and I certainly do it in the 7-week course and in my mystery school, is what we learn to reframe our life story as a great story and enter consciously into its dramas to find new metaphors for conflict and conciliation, to strengthen our personal structure. We discover ways to protect us from hurt, forge new bonds with both glorious inner and outer allies. And so I think that what happens with a new story is that it is, and it's happening all over the world, it's like a force field that is charging the incidents of our personal history with meaning and significance. And so one of the things that I do in some of my work is that I show ways of linking our lives with the experiences of the classical mythic characters. And then we inherit a whole lot of experience that illumines and fortifies our own. And we discover that we, too, are valuable characters in the dramas of the world soul, really pushing the boundaries of our own local story and gaining the courage to be and do so much, much more. And that's something I do in my work, as you do in yours. I think the very fact that we are in a very different time, and that part of the task of this planet is that, there it is, this our Earth is located at the edge of the galaxy, and it has such an abundant variety it has been given another purpose. Let's talk about the earth's purpose. And I'm going to say it's the preparation of God's seeds. And who are God's seeds? Well, God's seeds are companions to creation. And they enter, this is my myth, they enter into human form and experience with a task of learning from and within the varieties of incarnated and existential experience. They learn what it is to be in a particular form, in a particular time and space. And so bounded and coded and seeing and understanding their experiences through a variety of cultural lenses, they grow their God eyes, as it were. They gain realms of heart and feeling and love and horror and agony and ecstasy and celebration and humiliation that belongs to the human experience. And this humid, humorous, humanizing, humbling experience at playing, at being human, then gives the God seeds a range of experience that deepens his or her original condition. Otherwise, they would just be a graduate student, an assistant God, a demiurge, and more demi than urge at that.
Nice.
But I think that this God seed dimly, oh, so dimly remembers another condition, a condition of being where he or she lived so close to the source and was imbued with an innate wisdom and knowledge of things. And she yearns to remember her original purpose and the reason for her long journey here. And this becomes achingly so when the present journey seems ridiculous, repetitive, availing no further information. I mean, how many of you go out to any even drugstore, pharmacy, you know, bookshelf, hoping, is there truth here? Is it there? And then she does extraordinary things to help that memory. And what religion and spirituality give them is ways to find solace and comfort, and paradoxically, ways to so radically discomfort oneself that he or she strips away the veils of forgetfulness and indeed begins to remember. And whether it is through the politicized ways with the hierarchy and the bureaucracy of priests and of hangers-on, or whether it is the post-political or pre-political of the shamanic, in which one enters into states of altered consciousness in order to fulfill a larger tapping into the depths that are there. And as you know, as you and I have discussed in another talk, for the one who yearns for more complete union with being, there's always the way that experience, one could experience direct connection as you did in your life with oneness. And this, of course, is the mystical experience. I know you've had some remarkable experiences with that oneness. You've never really told it to me. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I'd be happy to, Jean. You know, for me, I'm really in that interim bridge generation after you, but
yeah.
Really
mm-hmm.
From a different era. We're in an age right now where the next Buddha is taking form as a Sangha. But when I was young and first entering into the path, it was the time in which a generation of truly great, bigger than life gurus were on the scene and in a sense inoculating a whole generation of us with a transcendental vision. And I had the good luck to encounter Adi Da, who was like many other figures from that era. People
who was
like,
my student.
Yes,
the first course I ever taught at Columbia. By the way, wrote the world's longest paper on the world's most overused what do you call it? Ink roll, you know, on the paper.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Franklin Jones.
He was Franklin Jones, and he was just really emerging. He hadn't really emerged into his own awakening or his his bigger than life capacity. So you really unite so much, Gene. It's beautiful. But he was truly possessed of tremendous siddhi, not unlike Swami Muktananda, the 16th Karmapa. There were a whole generation of great teachers. Chogyam Trungpa was another of this order. Certainly, Maharaji even Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, in certain moments, more privately, not so much his public persona, these were incredibly accomplished yogis who could, by the force of their meditation, melt down your visual field and transfigure your subjective experience in dramatic ways. And I happened to encounter him right at a time when he was involved in really demonstrating everything he could do. It was a period that was later called the Garbage and the Goddess period. I was one of the authors of that, of the book by that name, and we entered into a series of wild goings on. There were parties, but there were intense periods of fasting and meditation. And out of that, I had a whole series of profound experiences of my heart being blown open, my head center lighting up to where the subtle anatomy and the energetic animating patterns of existence became visible and feelable on a whole different level, and I even learned particular siddhis for a while. I remember him teaching me to make clouds disappear, for instance. All this non-ordinary experience, and it was expanded and changed my understanding of existence. I really got inside the subtle animating energetics of experience, and then even more profoundly, there was this transmission of radical consciousness at the heart, which was really the source even of all that subtle experience. And that deepened and deepened over a period of years in a way that was psychophysical, such that my whole body and mind and energies were really being repatterned in such a fundamental way that it just redid me, re-knit me from the inside out. And then what began to to take place was that I began to see in him something that at first I hadn't seen. The level of bliss and joy and radiance and brightness that was associated with my teacher was obvious right from the beginning. But I began to notice something much deeper, which was this unarmored presence to all the pain and suffering and difficulty and mortality and, you might even say, just the hellish gruesomeness of life's difficulty. And the realization that his awakening, as joyous and bright as it was simultaneous with an unarmored, completely unbuffered, vulnerable, wounded heart that was feeling every bit of the pain of
it all. Now, this is
all
you're speaking of?
Yeah, I felt that in him. But, of course, in feeling it in him, I felt it in me. It became obvious to me that, oh, that kind of joy and bliss that I tend to feel that seems immune, that is a shadow of this deeper joy that is completely vulnerable to every pain. And what happened was that the pattern that was patterning me was seen at a new level, and I was reduced from all that assent and all of that affirmation. All of that was kind of exploded into an embrace of the whole human condition. And that really changed my whole path of spiritual practice and spiritual life. Now, that my work with him continued for a period of time, but I stopped being so centrally involved, kind of focused on the scene around him, and the universal principles that were alive in that work became more important to me. And although it's a longer story that we don't have time to tell in detail now, what took place was that I opened and opened and opened into this tremendous tender feeling vulnerability, which was as if the very tendrils of my heart were kind of flayed with a kind of unarmored presence to the full spectrum of the experience of everyone who was in my presence. It was a disorienting period of time in which it was like a kind of a mystical ordeal took place for, this was particularly intense for a period of about 2 or 3 months. And at the other end of it, I realized that I was not meant to simply try to serve the guru, but that what I'd been given through him was meant to be given and served in everyone, and that the bigger than life personas like he and some of those other great beings I mentioned were serving an amazing purpose, and I will always be grateful for that. But that they were really handing a baton to a different kind of carrier who would not be the great one in front of the room, but who would be a helper of a different kind, servant leaders who would be co-creators of a new kind of culture. And that I had kind of the noble opportunity to get down on my hands and knees with others and create something right from the ground up. And when that arrived, that vulnerable kind of, you might say, there was a blissful crucifixion. That's probably the best image. A blissful crucifixion on this difficult time in which almost everyone is both ennobled and afraid. And to realize, oh, this is what I was brought here to do. And for me, the cosmic visions of light and the broken heart of joy resolved in a kind of simplicity, and in which the living presence of God was right there in the floor in the file cabinet, and the confused, angry person that might encounter me. And it really turned it all around and dropped me into a recognition, of course, that we had a real task before us, which is that these ancient spiritual traditions needed to be brought into a new synthesis. And this whole work I've done with Ken Wilber since then is the expression of that, an integral approach to our spirituality.
And so this integral approach which you offer, which also is certainly influenced by the long and strenuous path that you encountered starting when? Probably your late teens?
Yeah, I began on the path when I was about 19. I didn't encounter Adida till I was the ripe old age of 22,
yeah.
Though.
Oh, my. But what happens on that kind of path, you know, many of the great spiritual teachers of the world have likened our lives to sleep and a forgetting. But the kind of path that you describe is predicated on awakening, on going off of robot, of abandoning lackluster passivity to engage co-creation with, as you clearly did, with vigor, with attention, with focus, with radiance. I mean, you know, that's why I've called the mystical path is perhaps the greatest accelerator of evolutionary enhancement, because through it, as you did, we tap into wider physical, mental, emotional systems. And I think we really gain entrance into, I think what has to be said, Terry, is the next stage of our unfolding, both individually and collectively. Now, my question to you is that certainly this has traditionally been the province of the few, but perhaps this path may now be the requirements of the many. That is a unique developmental path for self and world. I have seen one of the last works of Adi Don, whatever his last name was, where he really talks about the social enterprise as being critical of this. Now, but I think of someone that I know who was a drunk and a wife beater and just an all-over mess up. And he was walking down the street one day, you know, quite drunk, and he heard the beating of a drum and he went toward it. And there was this sweet Salvation Army girl was beating the drum and singing something like, "Awake my soul, stretch every nerve, and press with vigor on," you know, great Protestant hymn. And something happened to him. Whee! Complete turnaround, complete reversal. And he became, virtually overnight, like all the circuits instantly rewired, and very different from your path. And he became this model citizen, this wonderful husband, this gave up drinking forever. And I followed his career until he died, and he really was a spectacular human being. So that we always have this tremendous comical dialogue, if you will, between the capacity that we have either as a gift of grace or God or being in the right moment at the right time where this huge conversion takes place, and or the extraordinary path that you went through, really living out the traditions and the practices of the world's great traditions, spiritual traditions. And so that evolutionary, what you went through was powerful, practical evolutionary practice. And yes, you know, when I have studied or talked with seekers who've had this or similar experience, they have told me of a joy that passes understanding, as you indicated, and an immense surge of creativity and a great uprush of kindness and tolerance that makes them, as you have become, impassioned champions for the betterment of all. I mean, bridge builders, magnets for solution, peacemakers, pathfinders, and people feel, as you felt around Adida, enriched and nourished, because everyone they touch becomes more because they themselves are more. And so I do believe that we may need the changes and accelerations of our time that put the flame under the crucible of becoming so that such inward alchemy could take place. But I also want to say I have seen this in little children. You know, it's happened in my experience, which I don't know if we have time for me talking about my experience. And I certainly saw in my friend when he, you know, followed the beating of the Salvation Army last, you know.
Well, that's such a – there are several rich things that you said. I want to quickly respond to a couple, but I want to ask you about your childhood experience because I think that's such a rich story, and I want us to have a chance to hear it. But before we get there, I wanted to say what I ended up realizing was that I had been taken through what I like to call the involutionary path.
The great path
of returning to the source, and you might say the mystical source. This is the source of love and peace and radical consciousness, and the subtle anatomy of the being kind of reveals itself, and you're at the very heart of existence. But there's also an evolutionary path in time, which is what our dear friend Barbara Marx Hubbard and now Craig Hamilton particularly focuses on this, and so does many other good people, Michael Dowd and others, that what was understood about evolution up until recently was the unfolding of the unmanifest into the manifest, into its fullness. And that is involution.
That's the explicate back into the implicate order.
That's exactly right. The implicate becoming explicate, and through that deep, deep transformational mystical unfolding, we become that. But then, what expresses itself then? The actual current time unfolding of that evolutionary process, which is not eternal and ancient. This is unpredictable. It is alive. It is creative. And right now, you and I and everyone listening to this is that. And we are in a moment in which there's a lot at stake. We could go through a period of evolutionary regression. There are potential dark emergents that are among our immediate prospects. And what we do matters. And the engendering of a new evolutionary culture, which means a new way of being with one another, in which we're listening at a deeper level and actually able to befriend and champion the greatness that is still nascent in that other heart and become vulnerable and transparent with one another in a way that hasn't been lived mutually in any broad scale yet before, and becoming partners at a different level, being able to, men like me, being able to encounter a strong and dynamic and amazing woman like you and not be working through old patterns of male ego or something such that, so that it's not complicated. Because we have things to do, and our tender connectedness to this living immanence as it bubbles forth in yet new colors and new expressions, we have to be a transparent vehicle for that to manifest in a whole new way, a metta-sangha,
A metasangha, yes. Well, do you think this virtual reality that we're now in is a metasangha?
I think we're in the early stages of scratching some new grooves in the cosmos here.
Yeah, very, very early. I know that Shirley Turkle, you know, who was at MIT,
has written a book,
Alone Together, which I just started reading this morning, where she complains about the fact that maybe she was wrong, you know, about how wonderful this internet connection is, because people are having very quicky relationships that don't take much time and energy. And yet within this all, and I think of all my young friends with their transcendental fingers, you know, calloused thumbs, connecting, but never being able to face-to-face. But is this also perhaps calling us to a new order of introversion? I think what's possible in the metaphysical Sangha is this involutionary path, which includes not only entering the silence and prayer and contemplation, a turning to the inner life wherein one employs some of the vast resources of spiritual technology, real spiritual technology, not something that an app that appears on your iPhone, you know.
No. This is the alchemy, the esoteric technology.
But there you journey inward to meet and receive reality in its fullness. It results as daily life, as a spiritual exercise, bringing the, as you said so well, the inner and the outer of life together in a new way. Now, what this is a situation where the divine presence meets the prepared body, mind, emotion, psyche, which has been cleared of the things that kept reality at bay and now can receive the one. And this is what happens there, is that indeed one is both oneself and beingness itself, or whatever you want to call it, God.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who enter this state, as you've described, it seems as if nothing is impossible. Indeed, everything becomes possible. And these are the people who become the world changers, the world servers. They become powers for life, I mean, centers for energy, partners and guides for spiritual vitality in other human beings. They glow, and they set others glowing. They're force fields, and to be in their field
exactly.
is to be set glowing.
They're no longer
human beings as we've known them. You know, they're fields of being, for they have moved from God's seed to God's self.
Because inherently we are organs of worship, organs of celebration, organs mm-hmm. of actual communion. And when we clear those obstructions, what stands forth is what's natural. And what's natural is a great thank you, a great rejoicing,
a great
celebration. And it's out of that celebration of an already okay, loving, peaceful, completely uncomplicated okayness with everything exactly as it is that we can be able to address what seem like such terrible and frightening problems. Coming into it from the place of the problem never exceeds the premise. It never outstrips that problem dilemma orientation.
Then what is our task now and in the future? Is it perhaps to remember more and more, to allow the veils to lift, and with it the old coding? I come back to the planet. The reason for this acceleration, which I'm finding, frankly, all over the place, this planetization, which in turn is yielding maybe a thickening of the noosphere, the spirit of the planet and her evolutionary coding, because we are harvesting now, not just intellectually, as interesting scholarship that you and I, you know, in our early lives explored, but essentially the storied road of many other cultures, as well as their immense body of technical, psychological, spiritual support, to be able to enter into sacred time, space, and memory. If I asked you, for example, Terry, how many traditions have you really experienced internally? I mean, clearly Hinduism, Buddhism, quite possibly Christianity, certainly Sufism, yes?
Yes.
And all of these.
And shamanism.
And rich yoga forms
and Judaism.
Visionary vegetables, which we don't talk about.
Well,
and
it, you know, it, 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 this goulash, this stew,
yes.
as you as a cook
the divine
know so well.
Yes.
It's interesting. There's such criticism of the cafeteria style of spirituality,
yeah.
and yet the interpenetration of these different influences is creating a synergy inside people that
yes.
is important. Sure, there are some superficialities that creep in, but people see so easily what's being lost and don't tend to notice the new as it's arising. And our stories of how we're all degenerating miss an important point.
Well, you know, it may be, and here's a new idea, that the nature of the gods themselves are changing. Now, I'm talking about God, small g, not God, capital G. Let's say that the gods are real and that they may belong to higher civilizational beings who also have the capacity to enter into, intra-psychic dimensions. I think, for example, in the Odyssey, Athena keeps showing up in the dreams of Persephone and others, you know. Maybe they show up, maybe they're able to spore themselves and put the essence of their coding into certain individuals. And maybe the sporing both helps and confuses, and part of the process is the ability to go beyond your sporing to essential spirit, as this happens, of course. The nature of the spore in us changes, changing the person, who then becomes of a higher order because they're being grown. I mean, I think of, I used to know the Bible quite well, Numbers 12:6, where God says to Moses about his special relationship to him, "When there are prophets among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to them in visions. I speak to them in dreams. Not so with my servant Moses. He is entrusted with all my house. With him I speak face to face clearly, not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord." Now, perhaps with Jesus, this may have moved to a mystic identification. I and my Father are one. That is, evidently perhaps transcending the local God, Yahweh, into the universal one. So, as I was saying to you before we began, I think the religion of the future will probably not be some great soup of world religions, but rather the powerful recognition of who and what we are as God seeds, as we join the larger universe and the larger purpose, which is really my ultimate plan in a lot of the work we do. What is the larger purpose? And that spirituality may well organize around this. What do you think?
Well, exactly. So that's the whole thrust of the movement I've been working with for the last 6 years, Integral
Yes.
Spirituality and Integral Life Practice, which is to identify, in a sense, the streamlined and essentialized forms that are inherent in all the different traditions, so that people who feel a fundamental alignment to Christianity or Buddhism or Judaism, or people who are atheists, you know, or just peak performers. There are many different forms of spirituality that need to be liberated, and the essential liberating patterns are universal. So it's discovering those principles, streamlining and simplifying them, because this speeding up of everyone's lifestyle, although there are negative aspects of it for sure, we're busy, we're interruption driven, it does drive us to distraction. On the other hand, we can practice in a simplified and purified way, and we can, you know, for instance, in the work that I teach, I bring people to a very, very powerful practices that they can do in just 20 minutes every day and in
sure.
random moments throughout the day. Such
Wonderful.
That the whole day becomes a continuum of communion and awakening and resting as awareness and the beneficial qualities of the mystery of being, such that we're constantly weaving in and out of that. And that kind of essentialized expression, I think, is emerging and also, what's emerging, I think, is a softening around our differences, a recognition of how deeply we need one another, and how there's an old Jewish story of, I think it's the righteous 36 men or something.
The Tzaddiks,
exactly, mm-hmm. who are holding the whole world. Well, we're in a time now where we need a righteous 360. 1,000. You know, we need a generation of saints. And there are so many people who are feeling the call to be among those who are holding a different kind of reality and who are reaching across boundaries and who are smoothing and noticing the places of difference are superficial to something more essential, where the whole human family is connected, where we say yes to our connections to each other and even yes to the discomfort of bridging those connections. And I think that is a more universal expression that's arising, and part of what's emerging now, I think, is also a deeper application to what it is for us to be together. I'm curious to hear more about your mystery school, actually, in relation to this, because this alchemy of combining ourselves with all these different dimensions and yet coming out intact instead of fragmented, in some ways that is an ordeal that each psyche has to find their own unique path through. Is that what you do in this?
Well,
extended...
yes. I mean, my mystery school, now entering its 28th year, is my 21st century version of an ancient and honorable tradition going back millennia, where in men and women gather to explore the mysteries of who we are, what we're here for, what we may yet become. And the purpose of the mystery school is to engender the passion for the possible in our development while discovering what that possible actually is. And in doing so, we discover ways of transforming the local self so that extraordinary life can arise. Because there's no question, as we've been saying, that a larger life is latent in the human species. And we live only a small part of the life that is actually given us. And so I think that I ask these questions in Mystery School. How do we place the local self in service to the higher self? How do we prepare to live a fuller life, one that can enhance not only our own life, but that of our family, our community, our planet? And how do we discover our highest purpose and live from it with beauty, energy, power, grace? So what I do in each session, and the theme for this year is this 2011 Mystery School, is what would you do if you knew you could not fail? Just to activate the energy around that. And so I work to harvest the ancient knowledge and imbue it with modern discoveries in science and culture and cosmology and metaphysics and innovative ideas, so as to activate powerful new ways of being and doing in our lives. And it's a very good school, and if people are interested, then they can go to my website, Jean Houston, as one word, jeanhouston.org, and learn a great deal about the Mystery School for this year. But in the 7 75-minute sessions that we're doing on Awakening Your Life Purpose, there will be some of this kind of material that can have the effect of greatly expanding people's possibilities as they embrace transformation.
So the difference is that the Mystery School just is a much richer, more thing where you get together face to face and really
face to face within a 3-day. It's 5 3-day sessions, although people can show up for one session. But it's very intense. And
right. So this other is a more virtual.
It's a virtual, yeah.
Experience.
75 minutes with a lot of Q&A, special sessions, and lots of bonus sessions, and
right.
PDF files of everything that's said, and it's really quite an extraordinary offering that the evolutionary wisdom people are doing.
Yeah,
and you may
wonderful.
Be doing one soon too.
I will be. Yes, yeah. I'm bringing together a course on integral spiritual practice that is not quite ready to announce, but I'm so excited because we're
not
really
ready for prime time, but getting there.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. We'll be launching it very soon, just within a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, did you want me to tell you about my little experience?
I sure do.
Got me loaded.
So this is what woke you up right at the very beginning when you were
right
just a little
beginning.
One.
Yeah.
So
my mother was a Sicilian Catholic, and her name was Maria Annunziata Serafina Graziella Fiorina Popecci Tedaro, born in Siracusa, Sicily. And she marries Jack Houston from Texas, who's an agnostic Baptist and a comedy writer for Bob Hope. Okay. Well, he has to become a Catholic to marry my mother, and he and the young priest trade jokes rather than theology. And finally, the priest said, "Hey, Jack, you're a natural-born pagan. Here, I'll give you a learner's permit so you can get married. Any kid comes along, you bring them up Catholic." "Sure, sure, sure," says my dad. Well, when I was 5 years old, Dad got kicked off the Bob Hope show for an excess of high spirits, and we found ourselves broke and living with my mother's Sicilian relatives in Brooklyn, or Brookalina, as my grandmother said. My dad remembers that he promised to send me to Catholic school, so I'm sent. Everything's fine, except he gags up my catechism and gives me the most interesting question to ask the poor little nun every morning, like, "Sister Teresa, when Ezekiel saw the wheel, was he drunk?" And, "Sister Teresa, I counted my ribs, and I counted my friend Joey Mangiabella's ribs." Everybody was Sicilian. "And we have the same number of ribs. Now, what I want to know is, if God made Eve out of Adam's rib, how come," and I had all 30 children lift up their undershirts and prove we all had the same number of ribs, you know. "And when Jesus rose, was that because God filled him with helium, Sister Teresa?" And then the one question that haunts every little Catholic child, and I asked it when the Mother Superior was present. "Sister Teresa," "Yes," she lisped, by the way, "did Jesus Christ ever have to go to the bathroom?" Well, that did it. And the Mother Superior ran out, and Sister Teresa blew up, and she screamed at me, "Blasphemy, blasphemy, sacrilege and blasphemy." And she put up a big sheet of oak tag, and she wrote on it, "Jean Houston's Years in Purgatory." Every time I asked one of my questions, "Blasphemy, blasphemy," big X. Each X would stand from anything between 100,000 to 5 million years. Anyway, by the end of the first grade, when I had just turned 6, she added up, and I had 300 million years in purgatory to my credit. Ran home, told my daddy, "Daddy, it's all your fault. I have to go to purgatory." And he roared with laughter, and he picked me up and put me on his shoulder, and he went running down past the Sicilian neighbors going, "Purgatory, purgatory, purgatory, purgatory. Here comes the purgatory special, purgatory. Daddy, where are we going?" He says, "To the movies, kiddo. You think you got problems? Ha! Wait till you see what they did to a real saint. Wait till you see how they hog-tied poor old Bernadette." And he took me to a great picture playing at that time called The Song of Bernadette, about the little girl who saw the Virgin Mary at Lourdes, you know, and then, of course, the whole Lourdes thing began. Well, everything was fine, this beautiful picture. The old lady sitting next to me with her chest full of, you know, holy medals, kept crossing herself, and everybody was Sicilian in that neighborhood. "E che bella questa santa!" Well, every time Jennifer Jones as Bernadette showed up. And then everything was fine until the Virgin Mary appears in the luminous grotto, you know, and it's one of the great, great mystical experiences in film history. When suddenly, and we're all in this rapture of devotion, when suddenly my father begins to howl with laughter, and he cannot stop, and he's going on and on, and the old lady is making a diabolical pointing of two fingers and saying, "Hey, diabolo, diabolo." And my father said, I said to Dad, "Daddy, shh, this is the holy part." He says, "Yeah, but you know who that is up there playing the Virgin Mary?" "No, Daddy, who?" He said, "I met her last year in that party in Beverly Hills. That's Linda, Linda Darnell. Hot dog, I told her she'd go far." Hysterical, because it seemed to him an unlikely starlet to be playing the Virgin Mary. Anyway, I said, "Daddy, go to the bathroom," because he couldn't stop laughing, and he came back, and he was pretty good, a few snorts to remind us of his true feelings. Well, we went home, and I ran upstairs, and I ran into a guest bedroom, which had a long, no clothes in the closet, because Chickie, my dog, had just had her 9 pups. And I thought, boy, it looks just like a grotto. And so I knew I had to see the Virgin Mary, so I crossed myself and said, "Virgin Mary, please, please, please show up. I'll give up candy for a week, 2 weeks, okay? And now you be there. I'm going to take all the dogs out of the closet so you don't step on them." I closed my eyes. I counted to 10. No Virgin Mary. Chickie was bringing her pups back. I pushed the pups away. "Virgin Mary, I'm going to give up chicken with garlic sauce and stuffed artichokes," my favorite foods. And I kept, counting to higher and higher numbers. No Virgin Mary. And I finally gave up. And I walked over feeling absolutely nothing to the bay window, and I looked out, and there was my grandfather, Prospero Tadaro, who knew of his feet only by rumor, so fat was he, you know, trying to put a smudge pot under a fig tree, and there was a plane in the sky. And suddenly it all happened. It all happened. Now, I didn't see or hear anything different. There were no visuals. But suddenly I knew absolutely that I and the fig tree in the yard and the plane in the sky, and then it opened up, and new wheat in Kansas, and fish in Sheepshead Bay, and old ladies dying in the hospital, and the little boy used to wave at me when we crossed the countries, we did all the time, in the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. And everything was there. Everything was dynamically related with everything else. And it was moving together. And it was a great symphony of fellowship and love and transcendent unity. And it was very, very, very good. And this was the nature of the universe. And then my father entered downstairs laughing, characteristically. He was always laughing. And the whole universe began to laugh with this tremendous joy. And years later, when I could read Dante in the original, the final words, del riso dell'universo, the joy that spins the universe. And that's
turns
what it was.
The earth
and that
just stars.
Kept me going all my life, that experience, the unity of everything.
So that really was the for you, the inspiring experience that was behind all the work you've done ever since?
I'd have to say so, yes. I mean, it sounds like a terrible exaggeration, but ultimately it is that which kept me going. I mean, childhood kept it full of energy, and adolescence gave it passion, and then I got stupid because I took a couple of PhDs, and that's how you really get stupid. But it really has always been there at the back of my mind, and that's why I like to tell the stories, to keep bringing it to the forefront and
because
it
really
seep into my bones and marrow, you know.
Yeah, that vision was for you the beginning point and the clarification of heart that you've drawn from ever since. It was that powerful, such that even the many mystical experiences you've had since were in some way echoes of that original
Everything
revelation.
Was echoed. It was like,
yeah,
kiddo, we're going to give it to you once and make good use of it.
And it's wonderful. And do you review that
all
Bernadette
the time.
Movie? Yeah.
No, I don't. I'm almost afraid to see it, you know, because it may be quite different.
It probably would be disappointing compared,
so
yes.
I have stayed away from Netflix and seeing The Song of Bernadette, but you know, it was an event that created the whole miraculous events around Lourdes, you know.
Yes, right. Such visions, you know, that have changed the world are, it's interesting to stand in this time where we have an integral perception. We can see that some of those visions, for instance, the Lourdes vision, you know, might be something that, for instance, in the integral system, we might categorize as a profound, higher, subtle experience. And yet, all those things are reflections of something essential, something that we intuit right at the heart that is...
Right at the heart, but I'm going to ask the existential question of you. What is orchestrating all of this? Is it just something that is essential in our being, since we don't just live in the universe, but the universe lives in us? Is it a kind of over-lighting intelligence, an over-soul, if you would, understood in terms of modern physics as a resonance field that is both generated by human beings but is not under the control of any institution or any religion? Is it that there is also a coded matrix which releases when times are right and the next codings of development, and we begin to process information, living, feeling, coming to us from the earth as well as from the matrix of the universe? So could we consider it an enormously intelligent life form which somehow orchestrates human culture through the release of ideas out of eternity and into the continuum of history? You know, is it that we are... I was looking for the Virgin Mary, and what I got was a much, much larger sensibility, but I was looking from within Sicilian, Italian, Brooklyn culture. But could it also be... an archetypal world which presents these ideas, these possibilities, these passions, these experiences for co-creative use whenever we're ready. And a child, of course, is always ready. So I think what I'm suggesting here then is a kind of new natural philosophy of the structure and purpose of the oversoul or the archetypal partners, the quantum partners, the archetypal world. And the archetypal world is routinely the place where the imaginative self meets the creative imaginal reality. And so, you know, these are very large questions. And I think about my old friend Terence McKenna, who was then paraphrasing Teilhard, when he said that when we discover that the imagination really is the ground of being, then it will be as if man had discovered fire for the second time. And so this whole issue of the imaginal world, this in this extraordinary time of change, that there are these great potencies, the implicate order, these great imaginal ground of our being, and that take us into a form of what I could only call second genesis. I mean, you and I essentially are second genesis professionals, you know, living
right.
in the wake of the post-industrial revolution and even the post-technological revolution, which has compounded all of our creative follies into ecological dumps and disasters, which would make us no longer appropriate to planetary life. So my friend Terence used to think that, well, maybe this is a stage of intra-transplanetary evolution. It's not that we're ecologically evil, it's just that our dreams and our creative aspirations cannot be contained on just a single planetary base any longer, and so we're being driven, as all the sci-fi says, into outer space as one of our alternatives, which may have always been part of our destiny as God seeds to help other cultures evoke, you know. And so the pop archetype of the UFO arises at this point to call us into a transplanetary destiny, Star Trekkers rather than planet destroyers. And maybe the passion play of the Earth that we're currently witnessing is activating us to get onto our destiny, to undergo a, what should we call it, a transubstantiation of culture and consciousness that will allow us to live and work and co-create in a larger universe. But I'm also suggesting that the sci-fi form, which probably inevitably will happen, but it's also the issue of that as we begin to live involutionally as part of our evolution, and we begin to enter into those extraordinary spaces of deep spiritual or mystical experiences, that too can act as a sociological catalyst and give us processes and techniques in which we begin to create a planetary civilization, not only with high individuation of culture, but also with the capacity to transform ourselves in ways that hitherto had seemed more mythic than real.
Beautiful. You are such a poet, Jean. It's just glorious to hear you hold forth in these ways. One of the things that comes forth in me as I feel all this, because that's such a vast vision, you know, this imaginal activation of the foundations of our being, is the thing that everybody can and must learn to do in their own lives every morning, every day, in any moment, which is to find a way to actually rediscover freshly the full, dripping, tearful, heartbreakingly beautiful, gracious, authentic divinity, the transcendental wonder of being. And the riddle of practice, of course, is that we discover that. It's fresh, it's alive. We can remember it. It comes back naturally. And then we try to repeat it, and it becomes a shadow of itself. And we're rehearsing something that's a dim shade of what had been so vivid and real and authentic before. And so there's always this new moment of a creative act, of breaking through, of rediscovering the real thing, so that all of these glorious words are not just words. They're pointing to a living reality that's right here and right now, and really transfiguring this moment and being the awakening and fulfillment of our heart impulse and destiny. And that process of learning how within oneself one can bring that capacity, that, what is it? It's a surrender, but it's also a trust. It's a courage. It's an act of it's an act that we don't exactly do, but that we have to choose. And it transcends that deadness, that serial monotony that you know, it's a lovely phrase that tends to creep in. And it seems like that is the core, really, of what my work is about, is helping people make that act. Mm.
To make that act active.
Yes.
To ignite the possible human and the spirit and soul of the possible human. All right, well, then let me ask you about this. New myths. And a myth is something that never was but is always happening, like the coded DNA of the human psyche. Now, when you look at the history of mythos, whenever a new mythos announces itself, it arrives at first with all kinds of prefigural ideas, like, for example, the plethora of messianic myths which preceded Jesus, the Jesus event, for about 100 years, mm-hmm. which we also see in Virgil's Fourth Eclogue, which was written around 10 BC. In our time, there are several kinds of myths that are growing, one of which have to do with myths of intervention by a hyper-intelligent entity that comes from the stars, you know, to reveal the right way to live. And you look at the enormous amount of time and energy the media gives to this popular programming.
Right.
It's sort of mythic gossiping about things to come.
Right.
But when you really look at it, it also is ultimately about the universe is calling us. The universe is calling us. And perhaps part of the postmodern spirituality is, which is grounded in, first, a new sense of the primacy of spiritual energy as the foundation of all social energies, even economic and political as well as cultural. And also about what so much of your work is about, the active seeking of co-creation with the spiritual energy that then can engage our social forms. And I would say not just our social forms and our experience, but the gaining of resources from, I would say, both archetypal realms and essential realms of unity. And then, of course, you have the mythos of spirituality as embodiment. And this contrasts with the old notion of a disembodied transcendence. And, of course, so this is, again, spirituality is rooted in the here and now, the kind of thing that Matthew Fox, for so many years, has called a creation-based spirituality.
Absolutely.
Our bodies
going from awakening to embodiment.
Our bodies become the way into the mystery of spirit and creation. And then, of course, what we're seeing now, because of the ecological holocaust, nature as the spiritual embodiment, the earth as God the Mother, as Gaia. And there's always a perpetual sacrament, is there not, in wind and wave, in growth and spring and dying and rising. Budding, fruiting, dying, resurrection, where we meet God in everything. And then, of course, human society, which can be seen, as it certainly was in the 18th century, as the natural expansion of nature's spirituality. The budding of institutions, the healing of institutions, so they can resurrect, bud, and grow again. And so I think that what is happening, that just as the small g, gods may be growing, it may be that the dream reality is also growing. And, you know, with my really fairly considerable experience with around the world with more and more people, many of these people are experiencing these inner realities, whether you call them dream realities or whatever, as a place where where there is a deep shift, imaginal shifting, and people are waking up and growing more and more in downloading, if you will, to use the current metaphors, these kinds of things. You know, every day, almost every day, not every day, I put out sort of potent nuggets of thought on my Facebook page. And I get, within a few hours, hundreds and hundreds of responses. And their responses are so much more brilliant than anything that I've put out, because they're about people tapping into the dream that may be dreaming us. And and it's brilliant, brilliant stuff. And it is these incredible insights on the nature of reality that in the past would have been scriptural. I mean, so potent are they. And they're coming from people who describe themselves as, quote, ordinary people. Although, quite frankly, I discovered that an ordinary person is someone you don't know very well. You know? So that we are guarded in our makeup. We are guarded in our makeup. And I think that what is trying to happen in our time is not only are we hologrammatic in our infinite connections, but that at different levels of depth, we are able not only to understand this, the universe in us, but then can, if you will, download or access it for our culture, our family, our institutions, and especially through, as you say, inspiration, intuition, love, rapture, the varieties of the creative experience, all of this being received from the ocean of being. And maybe the so-called genius, I sometimes think of genius as someone who finds, a genius is someone who is finding a way out of a particularly desperate situation, so he or she has to become a genius. But to me, the genius is someone who's able to hold several worlds at the same time. They hold the cultural lenses of a certain skill or knowledge base, and then they slip the boundaries of that base, and they take in pure essence of information from the great sea around. Mozart, you know, a very silly man in many ways, but in his music, he not only gave the musical base, the classic base of the late 18th century, but then he listens with his hologrammatic ear to the music of the spheres, to essence itself, and something else comes through, and it's restructured within the aesthetics of 18th century music. And this is what baffles Salieri. How can he go cosmic? Because he tells dirty jokes in public, but what he can is that he has coded his body and his skills so that he is an access point to the whole, and transfigures it in terms of 18th century music, so that when you look at something like Eine kleine Nachtmusik, Little Night Music, dum 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 dum, and then it's inversion, dum 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 dum, rum bum ba 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 ba. Look at it as a series of universal fractals that really are the nature of creation itself, that he is able to lens through his unique genius and the fact that his mind and body has access to the totality of being through his musical hologrammatic knowledge. And I think that is something else that I teach in my more advanced work in mystery school, that we can, through our particular skills, lens in totality and then recreate that within our particular skill or structure, as Mozart did.
That's beautiful. Well, you know, the latest all of the psi research is focusing now on precognitive forms,
yes,
in the structures of the experiments. And the discovery is that we know before it happens. And this rising energy that's so universal is an expression of us all sensing that there is an opportunity and a necessity for us to take a leap, to take a step. And this generation of saints and maybe multiple generations of saints linking together in a whole new way. This is what's upon us, and finding a way to ground that in a simple and sane and entirely rationally, you know, rigorous, clarified, grounded daily practice and quality of connection to one another, truly being friends with our deepest selves, our disowned parts, one another, the unused potentials, the opportunity and the necessity of a human transformation, a cultural shift, an evolutionary responsibility that we've never done before. We've never enacted in quite this way before. All of it seems to be building. And I trust that there is something in this group field that is true, even though there's all kinds of disaster-oriented, millennial catastrophizing and fear that's arising in the system. There's also something much more noble and clear. And I think that fear and anger noise that is part of what's part of our zeitgeist, much, much more profoundly, there's something intuitive and alive that is showing itself in the alchemy of people's souls and in the kind of beautiful work that you're doing and which I'm certainly contributing to in the ways that I can through my work. And it's just a blessing to have your leadership and friendship and support and clarity in all this, Jean. I'm deeply grateful.
And you who are doing such luminous work, Terry, in both precision as well as in the great patterns of becoming, you're serving, I think, the larger spiritual ecology of the whole. You know, I think the tasks that now are ours, the tasks of almost virtual regenesis, virtual creation, that are compelling the revolution in consciousness, and it's people like yourselves who know both the soul and the strategy of such a revolution. And perhaps we truly are the infant at playing the selfing game, and that we have the powers within us to direct this greatest of game, that we are in a time of partnership with God, whether the divine friend is known as the beloved, or as a sense of universal spirit, or as a transmission of luminous energy and peace. And of course, this involves what we would call an engaged spirituality. I think of the wonderful words of Bill Moyers, who declared that faith-based charity provides crumbs from the table. Faith-based justice offers a place at the table. Or turning to the work of a hero of mine, Jim Wallace, who was the editor of the spiritual political journal Sojourners and, you know, the co-founder of the Sojournal community.
Right.
He said that, you know, he said that we need to do more than pull people out of the river before they drown. Someone needs to go upstream to see who or what is throwing them in. And I think that spiritual life is ultimately about going up the river and stopping the ones who are throwing them in and creating a world in which you don't have to have the throwers in the first place.
Beautifully put.
And I think that there's no question that ours is the time in which we heal the hurts of nations through real partnership, rooted in spiritual partnership, even global marriage.
I do. Thank you so much, Jean.
We've
run out of time. I'm just so grateful. I do have a few important announcements I want to share with everybody. Jean will be offering the culmination of her life's work in a 7-week virtual course called Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, Discover the Essential Tools and Techniques to Activate Your Unique Destiny Code and Live Your Highest Calling. The course starts tomorrow. So if you're interested to participate, you'll want to sign up right away. And you can do that by going to purposeanddestiny.net, purposeanddestiny.net/signup, purposeanddestiny.net/signup for that 7-week course on Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. And I also want to make sure you know how to connect to her Mystery School and School of Social Artistry. Those are both available at jeanhouston.org or jeanhouston.com. And you can also sign up on her mailing list there. I also want to thank all of you who've sent so many wonderful questions and comments and who've filled out our survey. I wish I could reply to more of these. As I've mentioned earlier, I'm working on a new course I'm very excited about, and I'll be ready to tell you about in more detail pretty soon. It's not quite ready yet, but please stay tuned. And I want to let you know that some other really exciting episodes in Beyond Awakening will be coming up soon. I'll be speaking with Craig Hamilton on Sunday, February 13th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, with Lynn Twist, the author of The Soul of Money and the founder of the Pachamama Alliance, on February 20th, with Andrew Harvey on March 6th, and other upcoming guests this year will include Michael Dowd, Roger Walsh, Candace O'Denver, and A.H. Almas, also known as Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School. So thank you so much for joining me and Jean Houston tonight. Let's open up our phone lines so that everybody can hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us.
Bye.